So it feels like a momentous occasion. We're all here, all together in Studio 5 at Linux Voice Towers, which means that we're ready to record podcast Series 5, Episode 16. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
Graham McDonald Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this fun-packed episode, we've got news. We've got the finds of the fortnight. We've got the three-quarters of the way through reminder. We may or may not have some neurons to vocalise, but we definitely do have a very strong voice of the masses, a clarion call in the darkness, bringing us all together and also in the darkness binding us. If you like the sound of that, why not keep listening and listen to us the next time we do one? All things are in flux, as Heraclitus told us, but the one constant is that we'll be here jibber jabbering about nonsense. So let's kick off with something nonsensical.
Right, first up on the nonsensical list of news is Purism have raised over $2 million to create a freedom-focused smartphone.
What's Purism?
Purism, they're a company that have been around a few years. They've been doing laptops with some of the sort of proprietary nastiness stripped away and Linux put on top of them. So they've been running this crowdfunding campaign for a little while now. I think we spoke about them before when they were still trying to raise money, but they've actually succeeded. And the idea is to create a phone, put sort of Linux or GNU/Linux on it rather than Android with some vagrant Linux-y type things in it. Have a proper free stack that people can develop and hack and poke about. Have it developed, well, basically have it not developed by an advertising company. And
whatever that may be.
Yeah, and sort of generally focus on the user rather than people trying to sell stuff or spy on the users. And it seems like a lot of people want to support that. So
how much is this going to cost, this phone?
Well, if you did the crowdfunding campaign and you selected the phone option, you'll have paid $600. Well, $599.
Okay, that ain't cheap. But on the other hand, people are obviously willing to spend upwards. I mean,
people love privacy.
Yeah. It was never going to be a budget phone because you can't create your first phone to be a budget phone in this way. You know, you've got to employ developers and people to poke hardware in places, and I don't actually know what you do to develop a phone, but I think it involves chips and stuff.
Poking and chips.
Yeah, you take a load of chips and you sort of mesh them together and sort of sprinkle some solder on top, put it in an oven, I think, and
I think that's how the Amiga CD32 was made, actually.
Yeah, then you glue a...
I'm not bitter or anything.
Then you glue a screen on top, but that's going to take a little while to do. So, yeah, they're apparently shipping in January the year after next, so about 13 months' time. Obviously, that's subject to vast amounts of change, as most crowdfunding campaigns are. It's obviously they're not the first people to try and do this. This is it's a story that's been told a few times already, and so far it hasn't had a happy ending.
Well, when Ubuntu or Canonical tried to do this ages ago, didn't they? The emphasis wasn't on freedom necessarily, but it was an all singing, all dancing convergence phone, and they got millions of dollars in pledges, didn't they? Was it $7 million or?
I think it was $12 million.
So the interest is out there. The market is definitely there for a real Linux phone.
True, but despite all those pledges, they did actually release a phone and then stopped releasing a phone. they weren't able to turn that interest into a viable business.
Yeah.
Won't be reinventing the wheel as much.
No, I mean they're sort of building on top of standard Linux stacks. Obviously there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going to need to be done to make it work in a smartphone environment. And there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff, I don't want to say missing, but not there that a lot of people would expect. The chances are it's not going to have WhatsApp, for example. It's not going to have, you know, native support for a lot of stuff. And it's hugely important to a lot of people. I know in geek circles, people use Telegram and that sort of thing quite a lot. But, and yeah, that's may well be able to shoehorn that sort of thing in.
But I imagine the people who end up buying this phone are already aware of it. Like, your average OpenBSD user won't complain that they can't run Elite Dangerous or something. They know that's not what it's there for.
It's true, but the reality...
Or maybe I'm naive.
The reality of that might sink. It might be yet to sink in when you've got a phone and, you know, your mum can't call you on it because she's using WhatsApp and she can't work out how to use Telegram.
I was going to say that I think it's more likely that the average age of the purism backer is 20 years older than the people using WhatsApp and Facebook and all of their social networks.
I don't know. I think WhatsApp is pretty broadly used by a ridiculous range of the population these days. That's isn't like the average Facebook user 40 years old?
Well, could be. I don't know. Probably. I must say, I meet very few people who aren't on Facebook and don't use WhatsApp. Even the local school uses Facebook for its updates.
That's appalling.
And you have to be a member, so it's not like it's a public site.
Yeah.
That sucks.
And that's the sort of thing that you then find out, oh, I can't, you know, find out what's going on at the school on my phone. Obviously, it's completely sucks that that's the case, but it's still the reality of the world that you live in.
Yeah, but then I guess the solution is to put pressure on the school to change rather than to compromise your own privacy, which is, there was a really good article in The Guardian, actually, about, I saw it retweeted by Carrie Anne at the Raspberry Pi Foundation.
Carrie Anne Philbin.
It was... Yeah, and it was basically about how we're doing a reasonable job at now educating young people on technology and how hackers and makers and things can take things apart and re-engineer them and how to code, but we're not doing such a great job on teaching the same people about the aspects of privacy that they may be losing in using all of these sites.
Yes, I saw that article as well, and it was excellent. The... So sorry to bring Brexit in so early.
This is quite late, to be honest, isn't it?
there's been all the investigations over where the funding came from for the official Leave campaign, or their adverts that went on Facebook. And, of course, Facebook don't want to tell how much was spent, whether any rules were broken. You know, as long as they're getting paid to subvert the democratic process, they don't care.
Yeah.
And I'd much rather that your kids' school didn't support that, Graham.
Cause yeah, I agree.
That makes you an enemy of the people.
The saboteurs. But it's very difficult because, I mean, I have these conversations with almost everyone and I try not to sound like an old geeky zealot. But I know that's how I appear when I start. Yeah. Well, I don't actually use Facebook, you know. I don't have an account. I don't use WhatsApp. And they look at me like, you know, probably like I looked at my father or my grandfather when I was a kid. You know, I'm not using email. I'm going to write a letter.
Before this spirals all the way out into a full-on privacy debate with no end whatsoever, should we bring it back and just say congratulations to Purism? And
totally.
And obviously, I'm sure they're aware of the challenges they face, and we wish them all the best in facing them. And next up on conspiracy privacy news of the several months, however long it's been. Intel's super secret management engine is running Minix. So to pick that apart, the Intel management engine is a super secret operating system that runs on Intel chips. It runs alongside whatever OS you're running, Windows or Linux or whatever, but at a higher level of privilege in what's called Ring -3, which...
Oh,
Dude. Yeah, which just sounds like it's straight out of a spy novel. But basically that...
Even macOS doesn't operate in that level.
Yeah, so you have the... essentially, it means it can tinker with absolutely anything on that goes through the processor, and it can do that without any sort of either kernel or user space software even knowing it's happening. And this thing, yeah, it's been known about for ages. A lot of people have significant issues with the various security and privacy things about it. We won't go into that too much. But what came out recently is that it's running Minix, which is a sort of POSIX compatible OS developed by Andrew Tannenbaum. Sort of university, I don't know how to describe him. To me, he's the guy who wrote the networking book that I studied at uni.
Yeah, same for me. He's the guy that Minix didn't quite do what it needed it to when he created Linux.
Yeah, and for years, Minix has been under a really weird license. I say for years, it's ended quite a while ago, but it was under a really weird license where it was kind of owned by the book publisher. Because he created it for his operating systems course/book, and it sort of got tied up in weird licenses and properties. So although it was open you could look at it, it wasn't open as in you could use it in other stuff. But recently, years ago, it got brought into more open state. I think it's under a BSD license now. Where obviously Intel have picked it up, stripped out the bits they don't want, and thrown it into the super secret back corridors of your CPU.
It's kind of funny that most people listening are probably aware of the big internet news. NNTP, you know, Usenet debate that Linus Torvalds and Tannenbaum had back in 1990 or something, when Torvalds announced he was working on a kernel because he was sick of Minix, and Tannenbaum replied saying, "You're just a little kid, you don't know what you're doing." And there was a big debate, and Linus was a cocky kid, but obviously came out winning, or at least succeeding. And now we're in a situation where Tannenbaum could probably claim that more computers, not including mobiles, but more computers are running Minix than Linux, and Minix is running at a higher ring of the CPU. So Linux is just the
little monkey boy.
The little monkey boy. Thanks, Andrew. Linux is just the little monkey boy running on top of the giant grinder organ. I have no idea.
You see, quite a lot of people have covered this story as Minix is the most popular operating system, and who would have thought it? I'm not at all convinced that's true. I reckon there's more ARM devices running Linux than there are Intel devices running Minix.
That's why I said they're not including mobiles, because I think that's right.
Did you see Andrew Tannenbaum's passive-aggressive email to Intel in his open letter about how it would have been nice if Intel had let him know that this is what they're planning to do, when they spoke to some of Intel's engineers spoke to Andrew about relicensing parts of the code, and would he make certain changes without letting them know what Intel was up to? And he also used it in a strange way to emphasize the fact that he'd chosen, is it MIT for the license over? Yeah,
which is similar GPL to BSD,
It was a dig at Linux, basically, in the old Linux is a cancer way that you wouldn't be able, Intel wouldn't get away with this if it was GPL licensed, in a way that this is actually an example of how useful, you know, MIT licenses are, when to me it's like horrifying what Intel's been able to do. And in fact, Linux is great in not being able to subvert it to this extent.
Actually, I think you could do this with Linux because it's under the GPL v2. You couldn't do it if it was under the GPL v3. At a boring point of licensing, this is what's called the keyvoization clause in GPL v3, which means that even the keyvoization clause in GPL 3 doesn't force it, because that only says that you have to allow users to, if it is possible, to overwrite the firmware. But it is possible to overwrite the... I'm just thinking this in my head. But it is possible to overwrite the firmware, so they would have to allow users to do it. So yes, this wouldn't have been possible under a GPL 3 licensed kernel.
But with GPL v2, Intel would still have to share its changes.
That's true. It would have to share the changes, but it wouldn't necessarily...
what it did.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have to let users upload their own changes.
No, but I mean, that's what I'm more concerned with, is what is it actually doing? What's the extent of its capabilities?
Yeah. Well, it's everything.
Yeah. But the fact is that it's been secretly, I mean, that's the problem I've got with it, is it's just been so secretly and subversively done.
Does anybody know what the specification is of this secondary x86 chip running? Because if somebody can get a Bitcoin miner running on every modern PC CPU in the world, that would be pretty lulzy.
It'd be pretty lulzy, but they're not very powerful. I think you can pull the specs of them out if you want to, but they're pretty low end. Just powerful enough to sift your data out and pass it on to the NSA.
on their safe. Secret bright net that they've not. It's the opposite of the dark net. It's just a complete network they operate on.
It's ring minus four.
Yeah, how far does it go? It sounds like the Scientology levels, where they're like more and more OTs. That
do you think there's? Another
I had to recently.
Sorry, go on.
I had to recently sign a letter saying that I'm not a Scientologist.
That's what any Scientologist says.
Yeah, because I.
That is so cool.
Yeah, I've started teaching for an adult education centre run by the government in Munich and another one. And yeah, they put, as well as the other contracts and everything, they put this letter in front of me rather sheepishly. They just said, would you mind signing this? And it was obviously in German. And I read it very quickly, but it said, are you trying to spread Scientology technology? Because of course it's not a religion in Germany. But also, it said, are you an avatarist or something like that? I've got no idea what avatarism is.
Do you reckon they make everyone sign this, or they just thought he looks a bit iffy?
they may have just looked at me and thought, right, this dude is like probably... And I have read loads of stuff about Scientology and you know, their hidden materials that you can find on the net. So if I told them I knew a lot about it, I'd probably be kicked out.
Maybe they knew about your browsing history. Maybe they've been able to pull that from their ring minus three.
Oh, no. Oh, man. Well, maybe we'll discover another chip that's even higher or lower than this Minix chip. Yeah. And that will be running macOS. And then I win. I win the world.
The trouble
is, I would just be literally winning the world.
The trouble is, the only way you could do anything with it is if you went around with a serial cable to everyone's computer.
Yes. That's why I put no networking in it, to protect everyone. I'm the saviour of humanity. People don't realise, but, you know, c'est la vie.
Okay, should we move? Should we leave that hanging in the air and move on to the next item of news? Which is that a number of bugs in Intel's ME firmware have been discovered. And this is breaking news as we record this. It's only come out in the last few hours. Not that many details have come out about it. It seems quite bad. Essentially, it allows a privileged user on the system to execute code in this Minix environment, which theoretically has access to everything. At the moment, people are still sort of poking and prodding and seeing what that really means and what's actually possible. Intel have released a thingy that allows you to check to see if your computer is vulnerable to this, and you can update the firmware if it's not. So at the moment, that seems like the sensible thing to do. To avoid any malicious stuff happening on Ring Negative 3.
Oh, there's so much stuff to look out for, so many things to keep constantly updated. It's horrific, the future, isn't it?
It's not the future I imagined, to be honest. I distinctly remember in Back to the Future, they had like hoverboards and shoes that did themselves up. Damn it, I wanted Back to the Future, not 1984.
But Back to the Future 2 warned us quite clearly what we were getting into.
Hmm.
Also, 1984. Yeah, everyone should read that book.
Yeah. Right, should we move on to the next item of news? Slightly happier news this time. And that is that the top 500 list of the world's 500 most powerful computers is now 100% Linux.
It's awesome. Well done, Linus.
That's pretty cool.
So what was it before then? Was it just one or two Solaris boxes in there as well?
There was a couple of Unix boxes. I'm not 100% sure what the various Unixes they were running. But yes, it's now they are banished, and it's complete Linux.
That's really impressive.
It's a really good S-curve when you look at the number of Linux machines in the top 500 over the last 25 years, because, you know, you just get a couple of those early adopters in the early 90s, and then it shoots up over the 2000 threshold, and then, you know, we've just been finishing off the last few, the last five or seven years.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many of them are also running Minix.
All of them, yeah.
And mining
twice.
Bitcoins.
On each call.
And last up in the news this fortnight is that TrueOS, which is a BSD distro formerly known as PCBSD, has entered the DistroWatch top 10. So could this be the year of BSD on the desktop?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
That's great. PC, it's a great distribution. I haven't tried the TrueOS version of it, but when I last tried the last version, it was really good. You know, it's as Linux-like as you can get with BSD.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see what happened after the founder of WhatsApp donated $1 million to the FreeBSD Foundation, I think about a year ago or maybe 18 months ago or something, but you guys may remember that. He said FreeBSD made it possible to build WhatsApp, you know, to grow it up from a tiny bedroom venture into the insanely big thing it is today. I mean, I guess he could have used Linux as well, but for whatever reason he chose FreeBSD, it has some good features and benefits. But I wonder, I'd be interested to see how that's affected it, because the last I read was that a lot of FreeBSD developers basically run it in virtual machines, so they're not so interested in it on the desktop. They still focus on it as a server OS and doing back-end stuff. But this is obviously a desktop-focused version of FreeBSD, so yeah, I haven't tried it in a million years, but maybe I will one day.
Yeah, it's been a while since I used it, but it is. I mean, it's a much tighter thing than Linux. Linux is always sort of very, you know, there's thousands and thousands of packages in everywhere, and they're all various qualities, and you know, there's a lot of everything sort of comes together from a vast array of sources. Whereas BSDs tend to be much closer knit as a smaller development team working on much more specific objectives, and it can work really well.
Yeah. Maybe we should also mention the release of Firefox.
Yeah,
because
it looks different.
Yeah, and it is. I haven't touched Firefox for I don't know 6 months or so, but I installed the update because of the hype surrounding it, and it is massively quicker than Chrome and my old Firefox. Even if some of the plugins don't work, any of the plugins, although the Vim one does.
I'll have to give it a go, because previously Firefox didn't really run on my laptop. It juddered and skipped. I'll give it a go. I'll see if it works.
So this is the one with the quantum JavaScript engine or whatever it is that it's running in the background that they've... I mean, I really like Mozilla Foundation realigning with things that I think are important, such as a really first-class AAA web browser for people to use the internet.
Has this got the servo rendering engine as well? Or is that still to come?
I'm not sure, actually. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, they had servo and, what was it, electrolysis, which was separating each tab into its own process space, I think. So
it does that.
Tab goes crazy. Yeah.
It's got the threaded tabs and the sandboxing for the tabs.
Okay.
As well as this massively accelerated JavaScript engine.
It is cool, though. We've given a flack to Mozilla, the foundation, over the years for focusing on things we deem as not so important. For better or worse, maybe we're right, maybe we're wrong. But, to just have, at the end of the day, most people just want a better, faster, safer browser. I think some extension developers are a bit miffed by the latest release, because I think it just enables the new form. But I think the Mozilla guys have been in a tricky position there. They want, people want extensions, but people don't want extensions that have access to everything. And I think the previous extension model basically meant they could just do what they want. Capture your keyboard inputs and just send your data anywhere.
Yeah.
So the most of the guys are like, right, we've got to rip this out. We've got to do it again in a, you know, with a different basis, different foundations, and then people get peeved off by them. But you can't win them all.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what effect this has, because Firefox has been slipping down the ratings recently. If this can,
yeah,
this can pull it back.
And it's moved back to Google for its default search. Did you see that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. That, yeah, that's true as well. I saw a discussion about this. People saying, well, why is Google doing that when they just want to push Chrome? But Google, even when Chrome came out years ago, Google was still paying the Mozilla corporation, maybe.
Yeah. This is rather than DuckDuckGo, right?
It was Yahoo.
It was Yahoo, yeah.
And I think the deal with Yahoo was substantial. I hope I get this right, but it was $200 or $250 million a year.
Phew.
From Yahoo, indefinitely, I think, until... And it was Mozilla who could opt out of the agreement. The details I checked before you published those facts. but yes, I imagine the deal... Well, I don't know. If it's less financial incentive and more to do with usability or both sides, then it's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really annoyed with Google in the web space at the moment. I mean, they're trying to balkanize it and force
it.
Because the thing is, you say, the default web search is Google. But if you do a web search in Google through Firefox, you get a big message pop up saying, I see you're using Firefox. Why don't you download Chrome for a better experience?
Yeah, it's just, Hangouts doesn't work in Firefox.
No, a few
even
things
in
don't
Firefox
work.
58.
No, and I'm convinced there's no technical reason for that. That's got to just be, you know, just trying to force people over to Chrome.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. So I'm a bit, I don't know. I know it's hard for the Mozilla Foundation. They obviously have to make money. It costs a lot to develop a web browser. But it doesn't feel right to me.
Going back to Google.
Yeah. Mm. But, Yahoo weren't necessarily any better, but...
It's just so... I mean, I use DuckDuckGo as my default search on nearly all of my browsers, and I work with it all day. And I must admit that I type !G for probably 80% of my searches.
Mm.
I don't know whether I've just... Which returns Google results from DuckDuckGo. I don't know whether I've just become so... accustomed to the way that Google presents its results and the way that those results are presented, that I find it difficult to deal with any other kind of search now, that's worrying.
Yeah, I genuinely think it is a significantly better search engine than the other options. And I use it a lot as well, which just annoys me even more.
Yeah.
But I
find myself, and I've complained about this in the podcast before over the years, so shows nothing's been done. But the amount of times when I'm searching on Google, I have to go and click and select the verbatim thing. Because even if I put a search term in quote marks, it's giving me unrelated stuff. And you do a control F and you won't actually find what you're searching for in the page. You have to open a menu, click tools, click verbatim. I'm like, well, that was what quote marks are for, isn't it? I was supposed to say, I want this particular... And when you're searching for certain things, I found it to be like travel and looking for advice about traveling places, and you want really specific information, and Google is, I'm going to be really helpful and give you completely unrelated information, and it's mildly annoying.
And they do things like set edicts for the use of certain kind of keywords and meta information within pages, and things like the canonical pages that are redirected to whatever the website author wants to be the canonical page of a site. And it penalizes people who don't adhere to their specific set of values, which I think is also potentially powerful and open to misuse, you know, from Google basically building the web or the world of web searching totally around their own ecosystem rather than an open web. It's, I don't like the future.
I don't know how we managed to turn around what was fundamentally a piece of happy news into something depressing. Let's get back to that.
Everything's bad.
There's a new Firefox out. It's faster. It's great. End of story. End of news. Everything's lovely.
Great news. Thanks, Brilliant. Ben.
Thanks, Ben. So we'll move on to finds of the, I don't know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. There's been an awful lot going on these 4 or 5 weeks for all of us, which I'm sure we'll hear more about in the finds section. I will switch to IRC. I think everyone will be relieved that there isn't like 5 weeks worth of finds to go through. MacPhail has said, I don't think there's been any podcasts since I found this, but it's DNS 66 on Android. It's an Android app that you can install through F-Droid. I have installed this on my phone and it's brilliant. Basically, it's a DNS-based ad blocker and it gets around most of us not having root or not wanting to enable root access on our phone by basically configuring the DNS ad blocker as a VPN. So DNS requests are sent to the DNS 66's own DNS server through a VPN connection, which it sets up for itself. Basically, clearing the ads out of the IP addresses that go through the DNS and come back to your phone through the VPN, which is a really effective way of stopping that happening. Really cool, free, open source. Another one from MacPhail. My second find is the screenshot tool on Firefox Quantum, which is brilliant. Great for taking a record of the whole page, including the bits off screen. I didn't know that. Ah. That sounds very cool. So I guess you take a picture of, you know, a snapshot of something and you get a PNG or whatever of the entire Wikipedia page rather than having to scroll through. Any more? That might be just a couple. There's one from B. Herms. I have find that they've been playing with Mastodon, and we've talked about Mastodon before, an open source self-hosted Twitter alternative. I've noticed a few more people using it, but it doesn't seem to have reached critical mass, although it's been incredibly popular. And their second find is a cool web service called wttr.in. And it basically lets you type curl wttr.in, your zip code, postcode, and get a nice ASCII weather report on your terminal. And they there's a couple of exceptions to this, but they're the finds on the IRC channel. There are a lot of people, Andrew, congratulating you on your performance on Mastermind.
Hey. Sorry I didn't win.
You won in our hearts, Andrew.
I'll win next time.
So I don't know whether we should explain that Andrew, this, as we're recording this, Andrew was on what do you call it? It's a pretty difficult highbrow quiz show on television.
I'd say it's pretty elite as the TV quiz shows go, Graham.
Yeah,
it's
pretty
much the best of the best.
I err on the side of modesty, but yeah, I think you're right. Maybe almost as good, maybe, as University Challenge.
Well, that's gone downhill in the last 15 years or so. That's not very good anymore.
So Andrew was on British television on Friday night, answering questions on a variety of subjects, with his specialist subject being... I don't know what to talk about it because it's your thing and I don't know if you actually wanted to talk about it or not.
It's out there now, I suppose. Yes, the novels of George Orwell, because he's the man of the hour and of the day and of the week, and everyone really should read more Orwell and think about Orwell more. It baffles me when I see the way that people twist Orwell's words to fit their own agenda, but I guess that just shows how successful he was, that you can take from him exactly what you want. You just cherry pick the bits. There's an irony there for me that he's very, very widely read, but is almost has completely no influence at all over public discourse. People throw his name whenever there's a new security camera and say, "Oh, Big Brother," but it happens so often that it's utterly meaningless now. You know, we complain about being monitored, but then we go and buy an Amazon Alexa thing, and it's just weird. It's all come true. All of his works have come true, and he's well worth a couple of minutes of your time watching me show off for, I think, on the iPlayer for the next 28 days.
It's very cool. I was very proud of you, Andrew. Well done.
Thanks, Graham. I just did it for the nibbles. The mini burgers were amazing.
I thought you did very well. Yeah, I don't think I could have got any of the questions at all. So, does anybody else want to share a find or two?
I've got a reasonable find. So this is a find about the Raspberry Pi, and this is that the Los Alamos National Lab in America, they've created a cluster of 750 Raspberry Pis to make a mad supercomputer, which apparently, if they had a dedicated machine of the same size, it would cost $250 million and use 25 megawatts of electricity. So this mad thing is actually not just some weird, you know, grad student's experiment. It has actual scientific worth, and that's marvellous. Which leads me into my second discovery, which is my new job, which is working at Raspberry Pi, working on a magazine, which we may get to later on.
That's awesome. I'm jealous.
Don't be that jealous. I mean, you kept your Bitcoin.
Half a Bitcoin. Don't have a full Bitcoin. Not that rich.
No, there was a point. There was a point early on. I don't know when Bitcoin was like £700 or £800. I thought, should I like spend the extra £350 just so I've got a whole Bitcoin? And I said, no, don't be stupid.
I have a couple of finds. Funnily enough, the first one is related to the Intel management engine we were talking about. So currently, in recent chips, this crazy spying, helpful monitoring chip is an x86 processor. But beforehand, it was actually an ARC processor, which nobody's heard of. And an ARC processor was the follow-up to the Super FX chip that was in Super Nintendo cartridges like Starwing, or Star Fox, as real people call it, and Stunt Race FX, and I think Doom and Yoshi's Island. But so for many years, the Intel chips with this secondary chip, the secondary chip was actually a Super FX chip developed by people making 3D games on Nintendo. So I know, I think that's pretty cool from a random geeky viewpoint. And it also helps me to lead into my second find, which is that the Super Nintendo SNES Classic Mini Classic SNES Micro Edition, or whatever it's called, is actually really good. And I'm not saying that as a random plug for Nintendo stuff, even though I like Nintendo, but I discovered something. I have a Raspberry Pi with RetroPie, which is really good. You can load up all the games that you legally own and put them on, plug it into a TV, plug in joypads and play the games. But I was really bad at playing these old games that I devoted so many hours to as a kid. I was bad again at Mario Kart, and I was bad at Mario World. And I thought, well, it's okay. I'm old now, and you know, life has passed me by and it's time to give up. But I managed to get hold of a Super Nintendo SNES Mini Classic Mini Edition, and I'm really good at the games again. I thought, okay, is that just because I'm really excited by having this mini Super NES that I played as a kid now at home? But it's actually because the latency is way, way, way lower. Some dudes on the internet, on some Reddit thing, sorry for not being specific, but they did tests of the latency between pressing a button on the SNES, an original Super NES connected to a CRT TV, the latency between pressing a button and, say, Mario jumping on a real SNES with a CRT cathode ray tube TV is almost nothing. Super quick. With a Raspberry Pi, it's like 50 milliseconds or something. And with the SNES Mini, it's half that. So the SNES Mini is way, way, way more responsive. And the SNES Mini is basically a retro Pi. It is an ARM chip on a board inside a box. It is more or less like a Raspberry Pi. But it is because it's fine-tuned just for this software and this emulator and this particular, it's obviously running Linux, but because it's set up for this particular use case, it's way, way snappier. So, yeah, I love my RetroPie. I love playing old retro games, but I'm really glad I bought the SNES Mini, not just because it's shiny and it looks Nintendo-y and I'm a Nintendo fanboy, but it actually, it is really good to play on.
Oh, it sounds brilliant.
So what actually physically is it? You have the little controller, which is the same as the SNES controller. And does that just have an HDMI lead on it, or do you plug it into... Oh, no.
So readers, somebody maybe can take a screenshot of this, but readers, listeners, viewers, people who are aware of our activities. Yeah, it's basically about the size of a small lasagna. and like a Tesco lasagna, and the cartridge slot doesn't work. The cartridge eject slot doesn't work, but it's basically a small Super Nintendo. The power switch
sounds the same.
I'm turning on and off the power switch there, and the reset switch are the same. And yeah, otherwise, when you open it up, it's just a system on a chip. There, but yeah, it goes straight into HDMI, and its power requirements are so low you can power it by the USB port on your TV.
That's nice,
which is quite nice. So I don't need another, say Netz tile, whatever you call it in English, a power adapter.
And how many games do you get on this?
So you get 21 games on it, which doesn't include Pilot Wings or SimCity, which is wrong. But funnily enough, there's flash memory on it, and some enterprising Russians have developed a program that allow you to add legally obtained games to it, which is brilliant, I've heard. It's brilliant because it's a Linux box Raspberry Pi running an emulator that Nintendo have developed, but everything's, you can update the flash, you can add new games, you can add new pictures. So I've heard that some people have also added Pilot Wings and SimCity and other great Nintendo games to their SNES Minis to take around to friends' house to play and drink beer.
So can you do that purely over software? Do you need like some pogo pins or something to go and poke in on the chips?
Purely software, purely a USB cable and a tool called Hackchi, which can be used for perfectly legitimate purposes. And like BitTorrent, you know, just for sharing Linux distros, it's purely legit. Yeah, so you can just plug a USB cable in, run a program, and add additional... in fact, you can add other emulators to it. So you can add other Nintendo games that you own, but you can also install other emulators on it and basically turn it into Raspberry Pi with RetroPie. I'm not bothered about that because playing Mega Drive games on a SNES MIDI would just seem like just so deeply wrong to me. I have some convictions. I do have my moral standards, and that would just be wrong. So that's it. Yeah. They're beautiful.
That's very cool. Are they going to be as hard to get as the NES ones?
They shouldn't be, because Nintendo massively ramped up production for them. Yeah. And they are now, Nintendo said they're going to remake the NES Mini next year anyway. A lot of people came out at the time saying, oh, lulz, Nintendo's deliberately reduced production to make them scarce. But I don't think capitalism works like that. Like, no, people want them, sell them. But the main thing is, if the N64 Mini comes out next year, I will get to the front of the queue. Whether if that involves weapons and... The N64 Mini is the one I want. I quite like the SNES. I grew up with the SNES, but the N64 Mini is... I want to play those games again. Really. This is a
novelty. Can't you just put the N64 emulator on there?
Yeah, but I think it's pants again. It's slow, and the... it's just not the same. I want a shiny N64 Mini where everything's pure and...
I've still got my N64. And I still same quite here. Like plugging it in and, you know... pulling up with the RF interference and, you know, that kind of stuff.
And the massive delays as well. Like the PAL versions of the N64 games that we had were, I think, like 15% slower than.
Yeah. And if you watch people, there was no SCART. They were ugly.
Yeah. Yeah. But something beautiful about them.
But still great machines. I saw a small review. I don't know where you get them from. I think it was a crowdfunding campaign, but it's a small, it's kind of based on the NES or the SNES controller, and it's a key ring and it's Bluetooth. You know how you want to play games sometimes on your phone, but it's ridiculous touching virtual buttons on a screen. You can actually use this little key ring as a Bluetooth controller for playing games, like emulated games on your phone, which seems really cool. Thanks, Mike. Shall I go next and leave Ben to go last, maybe? Just all this talk about astronomy and the Raspberry Pi made me think that, have you heard the story this week, or it's been over the last couple of weeks, really, of the interstellar asteroid, which I think should be much bigger news than it really is, because it's incredible.
The one that's that really long shape, it's actually a spaceship.
Yeah, it's just like something out of Arthur C. Clarke or Rendezvous with Rama. It's basically the first object that's been 99% certified by NASA that it's come from outside our own solar system. So, you know, it's travelled between our star and some other distant star. And, I don't know. I think it takes 11,000 years to do a light year or something. So it's still pretty remarkably fast, faster than any of us have travelled. Humans, I mean. But I think it's really incredible that here are rocks. You know, if one day in the future we could land or grab some of it as it zooms past, you know. And my other find is that the Talos Principle, which is a really great game available for Linux, is also available for VR, virtual reality, on Linux. If you're fortunate enough to have a VR system that works with Steam VR, then the Talos Principle is a great game. It's a problem-solving game with a kind of philosophical element story that... But the problem solving is just ideal for working in virtual reality. And there's not much stuff for VR on Linux. That's why I'm kind of bringing it up, that it's great that the company that produces Talos Principle is supporting the Crow team. Another thing worth looking at is called Universe Sandbox, which is like this great physics emulator where you can hold planets and comets and stars in the palm of your hand, or even galaxies, and kind of spin them around and push them. And because it's all physics-based, they all operate with the kind of correct physics and the correct interaction if you accelerate time. My real find is a tool called Environment Modules for Linux. It's an open source tool that basically lets you create modules for your environment setup on Bash or whatever command line you use, and allows you to quickly switch between them. So a lot of us in Bash, for example, would use a Bash RC configuration file to set up a load of paths, set up, you know, the binaries you prefer for compiling with GCC or whatever, or the libraries that you've built. And basically this is a management system that lets you create very simple, I think it's YAML-based configuration files to describe these, but then load and unload them very quickly and very easily. So you want to use this version of GCC, you quickly load this module and you quickly unload another module if you want to switch to another one. It also works really well if you work with one set of tools on your desktop and then connect to a load of cloud instances. It works really well doing that, or if you're running great calculations on a supercomputer.
So, yeah, a couple of things have happened in the last month or so. The first one, in fact, it was a month ago today as we record this, my wife gave birth to our first child.
That's awesome.
What command did she use?
It sounded a bit like... But I don't know how you type that.
Congratulations, Ben. That's brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah, everything's going well so far.
Your eyes don't look too dark underneath.
Yeah. No, she sleeps reasonably well. Obviously, that's a relative thing when you're talking about one-month-old babies. But, yeah. Yeah, we're getting some sleep, which is better than no sleep.
What's her favourite programming language?
Perl. I think, yeah.
Respect.
Yeah.
So that's been most of the last 4 weeks, really. The other thing in the last 4 weeks is, like Andrew, I too have a new job with the Raspberry Pi Foundation, working on a magazine thing, which I believe will be launched today as this podcast is released, the 23rd of November. check us out at hackspace.raspberrypi.org.
Wow. Can you say anything about what the magazine is?
Yeah, I can. Just leave it hanging there. It's a magazine about sort of the hacking and making, hacking in this context being physically making stuff, electronics, and not just electronics, just think, well, actually it'll be released as this podcast goes out, so we can tell you all about it. What features are in issue one? We're building a smoker. We're building Christmas decorations you can control over Bluetooth. Making a nice mortise and tenon wooden box for your Raspberry Pi servers. We're
a synth with some synthy stuff, Graham.
There's a synth with some synthy stuff. We're liquid nitrogen freezing a Raspberry Pi to see how fast it'll go.
We've built a trebuchet.
Yeah, we've got a trebuchet.
That's cool.
It is really cool.
it's all about physical stuff, whether that's electronics, whether that's woodwork, whether it's metalwork, all that sort of thing. Check us out, hackspace.raspberrypi.org. It's available under a Creative Commons license, so you can just download it and check it out. It's also available in all good news agents. Around the world at some point, but in the UK from the 23rd.
Let's be good capitalists. In America you can get it in some shops that aren't newsagents, and those shops are I've lost the blooming thing, haven't I? Oh, it's not on this computer. It's on my other computer.
So I can do capitalism on this computer.
This is late stage capitalism where you have too many computers and capitalism breaks down.
It's nice to see that nothing has really changed in 4 years.
Right. I'm logged into the capitalist system.
Bring it down from within. Here we go.
In the Capitalist Republic of the United States, we're available in Barnes & Noble, Micro Centres and Fry's Electronics. In the UK, we're available in the capitalist outlets of WH Smith's, Tesco's, Sainsbury's and All Good Independents. There are also copies going to Australia, Hong Kong, Canada, Singapore, Belgium and Brazil.
Awesome.
Oh, and Ireland in the capitalist enclave of Easons.
How has it felt getting back into magazines? Because I bet both of you kind of maybe thought you might have left magazines behind you.
I genuinely thought I'd left publishing for good after Linux Voice. And that was a fairly conscious decision at the time. Yeah. And it was a fairly conscious decision I was quite happy with. It's been a pretty crazy... Well, how long have I been working there? 4 months, I think, now. A little while. It's mad. It's deadlines. I'd forgotten how deadlines were.
Congratulations to both of you. I hope it does really well. I'm sure it will.
Thanks.
And you'll have to keep us all up to date on how it goes on. It'd be good to hear the trials and adventures of launching a new magazine while I'm sat over here.
it's been a lot easier than launching the last magazine. Over to you, Mike.
Wow, thanks. So we do have, I've just discovered now that we have a neuron that my secretary has forwarded. And it's from Thaddeus Cantwell, who says, "It seems to me that window managers like Unity, KDE, GNOME, etc. have to iterate faster because of competition, whereas most programs' user interfaces sit on top of the distro, so are under less pressure to get people's love. This came out of a drunken conversation with Graham at Foss Talk Live about how the PDF tool to create Linux Voice didn't meet all of the albeit niche, requirements. On the other side, there is sometimes the complaint that there is too much fragmentation in Linux, but it doesn't seem evenly distributed, and perhaps the usability in some areas can suffer because of it. So, yeah, thanks, Thaddeus. I sort of see what you're getting there, although I think we are talking about many different things. But I think the point that people want to work on flashy, sexy tools like window managers rather than fixing long-standing bugs in LibreOffice, for instance, is a valid one. People often complain about the design of open source software and talk about how too many cooks can spoil the broth. You know, everybody wants to chip in and affect how something is designed and how the interface works. But on the other hand, if nobody bothers to do it, then nothing improves. I don't know what the solution is for that. We guys in LibreOffice, it's difficult. For instance, you have a big piece of software. Some people want the interface to look like 1999. Some people want it to look like, to copy whatever the competition is doing. But in the end, people should get involved and suggest things, and together we work on the solution. Design's a funny thing. There's a famous XKCD comic about a software project that had a problem where if you held down the space bar, it heated, it made the processor rise really, really rapidly, and the temperature of the processor go up really rapidly. And the programmers fixed it, but then people were complaining, saying, well, this breaks my workflow because I interpreted the temperature rise as a control key and I was using this in Emacs. So, yeah, there are always these corner cases. But anyway, thanks, Thaddeus. If there are any more podcasts, then please email your neurons. I think Graham's done good work as my secretary. So please email your neurons to ben@linuxvoice.com if it actually works. Does it work? Will it still work?
Yeah, that'll still work, for now at least.
Okay. Yeah. Or post them on, actually, this is better, post them on Reddit r/LinuxVoice. I'm sure it still exists. I think I'm a moderator of it, so it will give me a feeling of power if people post there.
You're still a moderator on Ash Linux Voice and Linux Format on Freenode.
Really? Now that you mention that.
You should change the subject.
Right.
Send bitcoins to this address, yeah.
Right, thanks for that neuron, Thaddeus. That brings us seamlessly into our Voice of the Masses, in which we asked Voice of the Masses, can free software do good design? We're thinking mostly about user interface, but process and usability are obviously closely related. Do you like Firefox's new user interface? I do. Or the way LibreOffice is going, do GNU Linux desktop environments look as good as their proprietary counterparts? Let us know. Also, sorry for the long delay between podcasts. Sorry about that. So, Rakios, while it's easy enough to spot really bad design, either from an aesthetic or functional perspective, good design is more difficult. Then there's the awkward matter of personal taste. I can't remember finding any free software that was unusably bad from a design perspective. Bug-ridden and generally broken is another matter. No, I can't think of anything that's absolutely unusable from a design perspective, other than maybe GIMP. Les W, I think the Cinnamon desktop is very well designed, both in terms of usability and visual appeal, so it looks like it can be done. I've got a clever, smart aleck answer to this, but we'll get a bit further down the comments, I think, first. Phil says, good ideas don't always get the feedback they deserve. Notable example, Canonical's Unity design. The difference with free software is that everybody has a saying and an opinion that reflects back. If, for example, I don't like something, I find someone else and we are two spreading our dislike, then we find 100 more other people then 1,000. Now we have a negative movement that's able to move further down the line and urge communities to stir more turbulence. Oh man, stop talking Britain down, Phil. That is how things work in the free software world, and in my perspective, it is what holds things back. Too much liberty and the twisted entitlement of you don't do it like my favourite distro does, you don't get my support, get lost. Yeah. Oh man. That's just so sad and so true. McPhail, the GIMP and Blender are both frequently held up as examples of bad open source design. I love them both. You use them every day though, don't you? So you've got McPhail, I believe, uses GIMP and Blender professionally, so all the design interface quirks you'd get used to over time. I'm thinking more for a casual user that just wants to remove some red eye or something. I love them both. I find them amazing tools to get things done quickly and efficiently. I suppose any opinion on design is going to be subjective, except LibreOffice, that's objectively horrible. Julian L, OpenOffice is certainly an effective, well-designed system and far preferable to the expensive alternative. The classic Windows UE is much better laid out than the MS Office one. GIMP is also very useful. Yeah. So, design. Anybody? Can anyone think? I mean, there are some pretty atrocious logos in free software, but that's absolutely of minimal importance compared with the actual software itself. Can anyone else think of anything that they've looked at and just really could not work out how to use?
Well, Vim the first time I used it, but that doesn't mean it's a bad bit of design. No, true. I'm genuinely trying to think of a bit of software that hasn't at some point annoyed me with its design, with not being able to find how to do something or something's been in a weird way or that's. And I'm not just thinking of open source stuff, I'm thinking of software in general. And I think I think someone already mentioned that it's really hard to say what good design is because you don't notice it. Good design is the thing that you don't even think of as design. You just think of that's the way it works and it's fine. You know, I mean, you only notice it when it goes wrong.
And then, like, how do you wrap up, how do you present a load of really advanced features? We could say with Vim from the start gives you every feature. Yeah. Vim doesn't give a monkeys. It just says, these are all the features. You can press all these keys and it will do stuff. It doesn't try and protect you. We've like in LibreOffice, for instance, okay, you could say the user interface needs to be improved. Fair enough. But you have so many features in there. Some people say, oh, make it a simple interface, or Apple, what's the name of the Apple word processor?
Pages
or something. Yeah, you know, which is nice looking word processor, nice and simple to use. But if you suddenly, if the LibreOffice guy stripped out all of these features and made this, a huge number of people would be massively peeved. So you say, okay, well, should we then make it look like the Apple word processor and then have a big advanced features button which you click and suddenly you get all the features that you have now in LibreOffice and other word processors? But it's a tough nut to crack, and I don't know.
Do you have these kind of discussions? Does the Document Foundation have these kind of brainstorming sessions where somebody says, how about making it look like Pages?
We actually do that, yeah. You know, obviously not perfectly, but for people listening, because it's not just me plugging what I do, because we're a charity anyway. But when people donate to the Document Foundation, we have a team of 8 people, and one of them is a user experience mentor, a lovely guy in Berlin called Heiko, and he's basically trying to pull all the different ideas together to improve the user interface for LibreOffice, which is obviously a lot of it's retro, a lot of it's old. But a lot of people are used to it, so you can't just rip everything up automatically. There's a design community that has regular calls every week. People meet up on Hangouts or whatever and talk about these things. You know, so they try to be pretty open. But if you change the interface overnight, people would be miffed. Other people want a radically new user interface. I really don't know what the solution is for that. I don't know much about UX, but it sounds difficult. A lot of programs don't have the problem. Like I say, Vim never has that problem. Vim will be Vim forever, and we'd like it because of that. It will always work like that, even though it's a pain in the ass to use it initially. It's tough.
In some ways, I think that's why the terminal is so successful. It's because there's a kind of, it's an assumption that there is going to be some effort required on behalf of the user to actually use something. You can't present every option and put it a single click away. With command line tools, you need to read something about how something's supposed to work before you actually try and do the action. And I think that works really well for the command line, because then you've got somebody who's already got over that kind of threshold of engagement, which you don't always have when you download a binary or you install a package and you click around for a few seconds and you can't immediately render a masterpiece.
Yeah, maybe somehow you have to make it clear to people that some things simply are difficult. Yeah. Like, you know, with my macOS project, I used to get people emailing me saying, I'm going to write a network stack for macOS. I'm going to write a USB stack. And I would simply forward them the RFC documents or the specifications. So you read this 40,000 word document, come back and, you know, we'll talk. They disappear. So, yeah, maybe when people are asking Blender to be much simpler or complicated feature in LibreOffice and say, why isn't this two-click process? And it's like, well, that's just not the way it is. Maybe we could improve it. Maybe we should, but I don't know how. You know, the criticism is the developers in open source design the interface, and I think that's a true criticism to a certain extent. That's been the way in a lot of open source, and maybe out of necessity because designers just haven't been there. But it's tough to balance, because if in an open source community and project where doing gets things done, so to speak, not very well expressed, but if a bunch of UX experts come in and say, no, you've got to change this, then may you just make more arguments.
Yes, Phelan Whiteley says, eject a CD by dragging the CD icon to the trash. It's design gone mad. Yeah, Andrew Bowden, when the resources are there, open source can be as well designed as any other software. Cinnamon certainly looks great and works well. After about 6 months using KDE, I returned to it recently and I'm in no rush to go anywhere else. Good design is always in the eye of the beholder. Although, did anyone actually like Windows 8? Now, I think that design is maybe the wrong word for this. I think when, like that, I don't like Richard Dawkins, but I like that a few phrases of his, like the idea of an intelligent designer that's made us rather than us having evolved. I think rather than having an intelligent designer, a lot of free software interfaces have evolved. And the things where design decisions are taken top down rather than as a result of getting gradual and organic feedback, they've either been very, very successful or very, very unsuccessful. I mean, the Windows interface is truly, truly horrible. Windows 8 just does not work. And that was a top down decision that would never have been made by its users. But then also, Ubuntu Unity was a top-down decision, and I think that looks great, and it works really well now.
You think it works well and not just looks great?
But it has to work well for it to be good design. Otherwise, it's just pretty and useless. Design has to have functionality built into it.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, I don't know much about, I don't think I've ever even really used Unity.
Yeah, it looks nice. It fits well on my screen. It doesn't get in the way. That's all I really want from a user interface.
I think Unity works well. I know it has its detractors, but I've liked it.
Right, that sounds like a convenient ringing endorsement of open source and free software design. Thanks, everybody. Sorry we've left it too so long between podcasts. We're lame.
Yeah. There's been a lot been going on. I don't know if we'll try and do one before Christmas, but I don't know. Let's leave it open-ended.
Okay, everybody. See you all later. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye. Ciao.